So welcome everybody to the final installment of Earthscroll Through the Ages, where we will finally actually discuss Earthscroll. But to get to Earthscroll, we first need to start with a little bit of background about English translations. So the question is, as always, why do we need an English translation? So as I'm sure we know by now, the main reason why we need a English translation is because, well, dudes were speaking English. And we're also afraid of Jews using bootlegged other versions of other translations. And we don't really want Jews using the Christian translation, such as the King James Bible, for quite obvious reasons, such as any suggestions why you wouldn't want people to use a Christian Bible?
That's a pro-Christian slant of interpretation.
Yes, right. As Dr. Johnson points out, there's a very clear Christian slant. Like, they deliberately mistranslate things so that way it refers to, you know, JC, right? Formerly known as Yeshu, right? So what can you do? So therefore, you know, it makes sense why we needed an English one and why we shouldn't really use one that's based purely on the King James and just say like, ah, it's fine. So let's go through through some of the English translations that exist. There are tons and tons of them. So here's a list of the ones we're going to be going through in chronological order, more or less of their appearance, starting with Isaac Leeser, Rabbi Isaac Leeser, Avraham Benesh. You'll also note that where these were published, as is probably rather predictable, were published in two primary locations, namely the United States and England, which will make sense because you have to speak English in order to do it. And if you're not from an English-speaking country, why would you bother? So we'll go through them all, hopefully. If you have any questions or comments, happy to discuss more outside, and we will see which ones we like or don't like and why. So as far as what is the first complete Jewish translation to English, so that title belongs to Rabbi Isaac Leeser in the 19th century in the United States of America. So he was a student of or follower of Moses Mendelssohn. He's known as also known as a Beerist. So you can also tell by the years that he lived, right, that he, you know, overlapped a bit with Mendelssohn. So he also made a translation. I lived a little bit, but not so much. He was from a school of thought of the Beerists. So he decided he wanted to make English translation. And he is the first one. He was a rabbi in the United States of America, originally from Germany. And as you can see from the front page, right? So how did he translate it? According to the Masoretic text, on the basis of the English version, the best Jewish authorities with short explanatory notes. Okay, published in Philadelphia. Right? So there you can note that the way that he did it is that he did it with the basis of the, as opposed to doing it off of the Christian text, he did it using the extent of which you can argue. Because let's say if you were trying to take a look at the notes, a little bit small. It's not necessarily the, you know, clearest of language, and it is a little, you know, old English sounding, but overall it's fairly good as far as the translation goes. And right, so the copy I found online doesn't happen to have the Hebrew attached. Presumably it had some versions did have the Hebrew, some did not. Depends on which one.
Why do you hear him?
I can hear you, Grandma. Let me just I'm gonna mute you 1 second.
Okay, hold on. Sorry.
All good. Feel free to unmute if you have a comment, just this way in case there's any background noise, you won't have to worry about that. So Rabbi Isaac Leeser, right? So again, he was a rabbi in America, and he decided to translate it to make it more accessible for those who happen to speak English and didn't really speak Hebrew so well. But as far as the translation goes, so say is you know, it still sounds a little clunky, such as the Parsha Vayigash. The Judah came near unto him and said, "Pardon, my lord, let thy servant, I pray thee, speak a word in my lord's ears, and let not thy anger burn against thy servant, for thou art even as Pharaoh." Right? So as you can tell, that doesn't necessarily read smoothly. It sounds kind of old, as opposed to, let's say, you know, it's written around the same time period, such as the Gettysburg Address 4 score and 7 years and 7 years ago, right? That sounds much better and sounds like real English, unlike what we see there, which is, again, in the more old style, following along with the way King James was. King James was written in, version was written in 1611. And even then, it was, you know, nowhere near as smooth, because realize that Shakespeare was written less than 50 years after that point, yet it sounds much more presentable to the modern ear. So it was already old, even as it was being written. So then add on several hundred years, and well, you get what you get. So again, he did it again based on the Masoretic text, meaning so it's not based on, let's say, the Christian version, which is based on the Septuagint, which has certain, you know, additions and subtractions from the Jewish version. For more on that, that's a separate class in history of the Bible and of the Torah, and, you know, various versions that cropped up over the centuries and mistakes that crept in. But also he did it following Jewish traditions, which is, again, he didn't say which are the best Jewish authorities, and he has nice little footnotes when there is something that's a little bit unclear, which we'll see is a very common theme. And you'll note that the people that the commentaries that he quotes, for instance, this one is the one of them is, I think that's one of them is Onkelos, one of them is Arcanine, so I'm not sure who that is, but is that Arnkin? I can't really read it. But point is, he quotes Mendelssohn. Right, ponders this as a negative, right? So again, so then he clearly, you know, fan of Mendelssohn. Sorry if that's a little small for everybody. The full thing is accessible online. It's interesting to read, but again, not necessarily your favorite of translations. It's, as I said, quite dated. Similar, the next translation is also similarly quite old, published within the decade of Rabbi Lieser's, which is by Dr. Abraham Benish. Okay, right, so this is published in England, right, so you see that he's a professor, right, so it's a little bit, you know, towards the academic side, but again, it is supervised by the chief rabbi at the time, and, right, but he was the one who translated it. Because he was the chief rabbi, I'm more curious why it says doctor. But, okay. If somebody here happens to know British history better and wants to correct me, feel free. I'm just, I don't think he is. So, but as you see here, right, so that it sounds very similar and to the version of both of King James as well as that of Leicester, and that it sounds quite old in its language, right? So he did it, you know, not like, you know, modeled after, but not solely on the Christian version, and hence it has some of the clunkiness. Then Judah stepped near unto him and said, "Oh, my Lord, let thy servant, I pray thee, speak a word in my Lord's ears, and let not thy wrath blow against thy servant, for thou art even as Pharaoh." Yeah, and equally clunky and words. There are certain degree of footnotes, but not the same degree and length as there was in Leicester's. So it never quite caught on that much. The Jewish school, right? So, but on the other hand, it was far. But there was the more popular one was Rabbi Leicester's, which lasted until JPS. In the interim, there is another version that was published out of England as well, namely that of the Michael Friedlander Jewish Family Bible. You may know him for his translations of the Mor Nevuchim and other works as well. He translated many, many things, right? So his issue is that basically he started with the King James Version more or less and just fixed up all the trace parts and cleaned it up. But the problem with that is that that means it still has the same issues of being clunky like King James. And yeah, so we'll still have its issues, but again, it's very important. It's important though, because this translation is used as the basis for the later for the Koran Jerusalem Bible, which we'll get to. So as far as the first, you know, modern attempted one, sorry for not having a full version of the Jewish Family Bible. I couldn't find any extant copies online. And I didn't have a chance to visit U of T. So they have one, but I don't have access. So Okay, so instead, let's focus on JPS 1917, which is perhaps the more famous one, mostly because it's been free online for a very long time, and as well as being relatively standard. When I say relatively standard, I mean this is the translation that everybody recognizes because it's utilized by the Hertz Commish and everything put out by Cencino. So there are quite a few things that one would expect to have been there, but are actually not there. Right? So for instance, so this is a excerpt from its preface, right? So right, the repeated efforts by Jews in the field of biblical translations show the sentiment towards translations prepared by other denominations. The dominant feature of the sentiment apart from the thought that the Christological interpretations of non-Jewish translations are out of place in the Jewish Bible isn't what the Jew can afford to have in a Bible translation prepared for him by others. Main point being, we can't have translation based on Christian ideas is bad, right? As we have established for up till now. Right, and if a new country and a new language metamorphose him into a new man, the duty of this new man is to prepare a new garb and a new method of expression for what is most sacred and most dear to him, meaning we need to create our own translation. So pluses of the 1917 version are, it is very literal, but of course the detraction from it is that, well, yes, it's very literal. Yes, it is written in very old English because the editors decided that they wanted it to be as similar and as reputable and as grand as King James was, which led to a lot of clunky translation. We could read more, but for more on that, please, you feel free to look at the Cencino. For those who are not here in person, you would see the many versions I have on the table here. Unfortunately, you are not, so I guess those who are not here will miss out on the leafing through the in-person party afterwards. So the next thing I have heard a special request for the Hertz Chumash. So if you want to hear a full version of it, I recommend you look at Mitchell First's article on the topic. If you search for Hertz Chumash, it comes up first. He wrote for the Jewish Link. He also has a book, which is included in as well, I think at this point, about certain things in Jewish history. Excellent read. So a lot of the stuff from here is actually from Wikipedia, though. It's because, well, I haven't read all of the Hertz due to the fact that it was no longer in style by the time that I was born. So what can you do? It's technically more part of a, it's important for it being a commentary more so than it being a translation, because it is an English commentary written in English for the intended audience, right? About things that people thought were that Rabbi Hertz thought was relevant. And so again, it includes a lot of very commentaries of Rashi, Ben Ezra, Ramban, Radak, Sfarnim, Ralbag, and many others. But also worthy of note that it's not actually translated entirely by Hertz, nor is it the commentary. He wrote the one on Bereishit, but the rest of them were actually done by others that he then edited to make them look like they were done by one person. So again, it's an excellent commentary, utilizing the extant scholarship at the time, but unfortunately, it is not technically a translation in the true sense, because in the original version he may have used his own translation, but in the end he decided to stick in 1917 JPS for most purposes. Right, he quoted Christian sources when he felt that it was appropriate and correct. So some people don't like that, because how dare you quote anything Christian? But he's like, if they're good points, they have a good point, and he didn't have a problem with it. Whether that was right or wrong, that's a separate discussion, which is beyond the scope of our class tonight. Utilizing things from impure sources. So as far as the other people may have heard of, right? So this is the Pentateuch and Rashi's commentary, right, by Avram Ben Yeshaya, Benjamin Sharfman, Harry Orlinsky, and Morris Scharner, right? So here, right, so it's more notable for its translation of Rashi than it is for its translation of the text, but it also did translate the text, but it utilizing the JPS 1917 and then amending it as it saw to see fit, so it would look nicer in this in its side-by-side linear translation, meaning like one word, or like two, three words at a time, and as well as they liked Rashi. So if you're saying like, oh, how dare Art Scroll? Well, they're not the first. So a lot of people liked Rashi and thought that he was the person to go by for translation. As far as other points about Art Scroll, feel free to shout them out when we get to the Art Scroll section. So another one worthy of note is that of the Living Torah by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, finished in 1981, right? His main goal was to make it clear and readable to even young children, right? Keep it as close as possible to the original meaning, even if you're not translating word for word, right? Such as, so in his introduction, he quotes the fact that, you know, the Rambam says that any translation is inherently can't be word for word, it can't be exact, because things don't always translate. So he says, so he followed that sentiment, just like Rav Sadegon had as well, and is like, yeah, so it won't be truly exact. And he's like, I'd rather you understand than let me get every word right, because the point is for people to understand it. He also included lots of pictures and diagrams and maps when he felt pertinent. And also worthy to note is that there actually is no Hebrew in the Living Torah, Chumash and Haftarah, at least not one that I found. There is one that does, but not one that I could, that the shul has. It's pretty thick, the English only. So if you had the combined one, I think you can see it, it's pretty thick. Right, it's several hundred pages. So there is a Hebrew. So I think there is a 1500 page one that includes the Hebrew, but I don't have that one here. So sorry, I don't have to catch up to you. But it exists. One that is both, just not one that I have. Okay, so it does exist. My apologies. There is a Hebrew one as well. Just the most of the ones you'll see are the English one, and there's some that we'd use it parallel with another Chumash because. It's very large. Okay. But again, it's very good, easy to use, but fault being that it's not necessarily the most literal of translations. So it has its audience. And at the end, everybody's welcome to vote which one they found to be the best, as well as which one they personally like to use. So yeah, there is no wrong answer as long as you don't vote for King James. So not to worry. So now one of the more popular ones is, again, not necessarily amongst, Jewish circles, but in general, is that of the new JPS, right? JPS from 1985, right? It says in this science post before, it's made directly from the Hebrew without remotely referencing the old King James, and their goal was to make it more idiomatic. And the idiom of modern English, as you see quoted there. So they did. The only problem that I personally, when I went through Tanakh the first time, I did it largely with the JPS Tanakh, largely because it is relatively small, and it was, like $20. So, and I could get it with the Barnes & Noble gift card. So the only thing that I personally find a little confusing about it is that it doesn't quite line up so well with the Hebrew on the side. It's a little off. And the fact that randomly when you get to anything that's poetry, it starts deviating from the way that the normal Hebrew text would look. And it's a little hard to read because of it. And also because they wanted to include a lot of the more academic discoveries that happened in the meantime, they often have a lot of their little footnotes saying unclear. On a lot of points. So again, if you look at their actual commentary of the JPS, it explains why. But in the standard Tanakh, you see a lot of meaning of the text of Hebrew uncertain, and you're just like, so then what does that mean? And you're like left wanting, which is something that doesn't happen with our translations because they tend to just stick in the one that they think. But if they felt that this is a whole paper that we could stick in here instead, they just left as we don't know.
Was it in the modern English?
It's in the modern English. If you go on Sfaria, you can see its translation as well as there's a lot of different translations there. It's one of the ones listed there. I could pass you. Do we have? I can read out here. I'll read out the way it. I didn't put it in the way that JPS 1985 sounds for the beginning of Vayigash. Here we go. So then Judah went up to him and said, "Please, my lord, let your servant appeal to my lord, and do not be impatient with your servant, you who are the equal of Pharaoh." Okay, so then we lost all the these and the thous. So definitely sounds much better, but is it still utilizing, you know, Judah instead of Yehuda, which bothers some people because they're like, why, if I know that we're not translating it based on the original Hebrew, you should not have gotten that. You should have written it as Yehuda because we can all read Hebrew. JPS, why can't you? Also, when you're, but again, the answer is they did that because the convention is we're reading the English tended to know the Christian, the versions that were mispronounced due to the double translation into Greek law and the losing of the switching of the Y for the J. Hence, you know, Yanai versus Jason, things like that. So yeah, like Yoshua, Joshua, it's because it doesn't exist in Greek. So translational problems. For more on that, please ask your local linguist. But that's why Yoshua becomes Joshua, because you lost several syllables in there. Okay, and then another one that worthy of note is the Koran translation, the Koran Jerusalem Bible from 1967. So this one is an in-depth translation by Professor Harold Fish. It is based on the version of the Friedlander translation done under the auspices of Dr. Adler. And then he also consulted with the Bible of Isaac Leeser and with other later translations. So he utilized basically all of them, right? Equal opportunity. So if you want, so I can read also the first here. Sorry for opening all on the slideshow. Just at a certain point, there'll be no more text left. So a very helpful point that they had in their text is that it's actually formatted very closely to that of the Hebrew, and that it has the paragraph breaks line up pretty very well, as do the sentences, which makes it for a much easier and smoother read for somebody looking from one side to the other side. But one of the critiques that they have here says, let me read the English, and you'll see what some of the critiques are. Then Yehuda came near to him and said, "O my lord, let thy servant, I pray thee, speak a word in my lord's ears, and let not thy anger burn against thy servant, for thou art even as Paro." And also, I'll point out that the word Paro is spelled P-A-R-O. So people didn't like the fact that, well, A, it's still written in Old English, and the transliteration style, well, yes, making it easier to connect to the original Hebrew. When anybody's reading it, they're like, "What?" Because like it's you'll pronounce it as Paro properly. And it's got a little apostrophe here that's an I in it, opposed to an olive, because posture is going towards one way, not the other way. But which is academically correct. But most people, when they see that, they're just like, "I don't know what you're doing." So that is a fault. Not necessarily their fault. It's just that is an issue that comes up in the 1967 version of the Koran Tanakh. So then the next version that came, I realized that went out of order a little bit. I guess I forgot. I guess the slides. Yeah, because we went 81, 67, now back to 76. So this is 1976. This is the Art Scroll Stone Edition. So this one actually took a while before it's entirely all finished. All the various parts. So I just want to point out some of the approaches done by Art Scroll when they were translating. So depending on the version, not every intro actually explains it, but in the intro to Bereishit, back when it was still broken up into sections before it was put into the one stone Chumash or into the stone Tanakh. So here was the introduction that it said there. So it said, following our approach in the previous volumes of the five Megillas, if I pronounced it correctly, a new translation was prepared, which in contemporary lucid English attempts to render the text in a manner faithful to the exegesis of the sages. Well, Targumim and commentaries with their varying interpretations raise a serious question of how to decide upon a definitive translation. Upon guidance of the Rosh HaYeshiva, the commentary of Rashi has been followed in all instances because he is the father of commentators. So they followed Rashi. So many people are like, so that's great. Like, we love Rashi. What's the problem? Other people are like, well, Rashi's has been Midrashi interpolations, right? If he feels the Midrash is a good fit with the text, he'll put it in. That's not necessarily, you know, the simplest, plainest meaning of the text. And some people don't like it for that reason. Some people often like to point out the problem of the way that, let's say, for Shir HaShirim, which they also translated according to Rashi, where the primary text is the... So Rashi says that the entirety of the book of Song of Songs is written in the form of a parable, right? So there's the mashal and the nimshal, right? The parable itself and then the lesson that what it actually means. So what they did is if you were looking at your art scroll master, you'd only see the parable, you'd only see the rabbinic interpretation of the parable, the nimshal, which would be a problem, according to many. But if you look at the actual Arshul Tanakh, so on top they have the Nimshal, right? The Chazal Rashi says it's what it means. And on the bottom, they put the whole translation. They just switch the way they normally do it because they're like, well, they're a little uncomfortable with some of the graphic imagery utilized by Shlomo HaMelech. They couldn't handle his wisdom, so they decided to put it on the bottom instead of on top. What can you do? So, but as far as for the rest of the prophets, so again, they also looked to the guidance of great mentors, and they were more eclectic. The translation of those books utilizes basically everybody: Targum, Ramban, Radak, Ralbag, Ibn Ezra, Kara, Matsudas, Malbim. Also Rashi, right? And they try to choose the creation that fits best. And also another unique thing that. Unique to art scroll that normally people have been using the words Lord or God. So instead, they switched out for Yudke Vavke, they switched out the word Hashem, right? Because they didn't feel it's appropriate to use God's name that way. And they wrote in the word God instead of Elohim, right? So default Yudke Vavke is Hashem, and Elohim became God, right? Or other versions or other names of God became just plain God, capital G. So, and that was that. So as far as, you know, art scroll, so the answer is, well, the reason why this series is called art scroll is because, well, it is by far the most popular, mainly for its excellent typesetting and legibility, as well as for their excellent business practices and publicity. So, and being well-priced for shuls. So that again, issues people have with it that I personally, I mean, so as far as this Hebrew text is very good. Criticism of the English text include, well, it follows Rashi, and the fact that it's all in italics, which if you're reading for a long time, can give you a headache sometimes. But overall, very solid translation. You could argue about and quibble about some of the points that it does for translation, but overall, a decent translation. And you can also be troubled by the fact that it says, we asked our rabbis and our Rosh HaYeshiva, and there's no name there, which also is a little troubling for many people, because they're like, well, who's the one who signed off on it? Like, I'd like to know who it is. And because calling them the amorphous, the Rosh HaYeshiva, without knowing who all of them are, makes people be like, we like transparency. And so, thank you, Rabbi Nesson Sherman, for your excellent translation, but we want to know who you consulted. Because, I mean, I'm just curious. So, anyway, that's just me. So, other translations that have occurred since. So, notable is, so this one is far more academic in nature. This is that of Robert Alter. So, it is not a translation that is meant to be as accurate as possible for the meaning of the words. Rather, the goal was to try and allow the reader to be able to tell the original poetic nature of the text. For instance, a native Hebrew speaker can tell parallels in let's say if the same word is utilized like four different times, but it's like different forms. So it will be very clear for a Hebrew reader that clearly something's going on. But for the average reader in English, you might have no idea that there's a parallel. And when you think there is a parallel, there might not be. So he tries his best to, you know, to try and translate words consistently to that effect. but that also sometimes leads to some clunkiness in translation. Many people really like it and say it's very elegant, and some say that no, because you tried doing that, you made a bad translation, and because you can never fully duplicate that sort of style, especially when you're translating it into English. If you're translating into another Semitic language, let's say what Targum Onkelos did, you know, maybe you could have pulled it off, but if you're translating into English, it just doesn't really do the trick. And so, but again, unique to it is also that it's entirely translated by an individual, by Robert Alter. Again, you can argue that he's a little more academic, that he is an actual academic. So some people don't like his translation for that reason, but overall, it is many people very much enjoy his translation. Also can be purchased online. Okay, and last but not least, we have the Koran Tanakh, which is right. So now here, this is the from their introduction to it. I don't have a physical copy. I mean, I should, but I forgot to order one when it was on sale last week. And now, but it's $20 from Koran's website if you want to order it in Canada. They have large print, small print, like soft cover, hardcover, your choice. They have it. So. Right, so they, so again, it was overall. So the Torah and Psalms were translated by Rabbi Sacks, right? So so Koran realized their critiques of the previous ones, such as the problem for the weird transliteration scheme that was academically correct but made everybody feel weird reading the name Yaakov, right? Because if you speak English like a Yemenite does, that's perfectly fine. If you don't, and you see those words, you're like, I don't know who that is. So, right, so some people, so right, so you see here, so they turned it back to Yaakov and Rivka, got rid of the Q's, but don't like Q's, it confuses them, right? And they tried, so if it was a word that you would have actually heard of in real life, they use the commonly accepted colloquial spelling, even if it was academically correct. But of course, if it was, you know, for the name of a place somewhere in Tanakh, for an actual place, and people wouldn't have known the difference with this way or that, they're like, well, let's just, you know, instead of doing Jezreel, they'll go with Yisrael for the valley that way and spell it fully properly, because they're like, well, Jezreel means nothing to anybody anyways, so we may as well do the one that's right. Okay, so they make so they note the fact that they try and be as literal as possible in translation, right? They do follow the school overall Pashtanim for a full comparison of how they do that well or not. I don't know, because I have not read the entirety of their Tanakh, but they say that's what they're doing, so I'll have to keep it. So presumably that's what they're aiming for. They have minimal commentaries on the bottom. And, but overall, right, so it's very good in terms of the fact they also include nice maps, charts, timelines, genealogies, and illustrations, in addition to having a very good font, which is Koran is well known for their good font. And so many people very much knew it for that reason. And, again, if somebody would like a more modern translation, that one definitely fits the bill. So now just for one last one comparison, comparing King James versus the Living Torah in terms of the, you know, again, Rabbi Kaplan's is probably the least literal, but as far as most readable one. So in terms of the Yosef's big reveal to his brothers, so we can vote on which one we think does a better job of making us feel connected, the version of King James or the version of Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. The Living Torah. So, King James is, and Joseph could not refrain himself before all them that stood by him, and he cried, cause every man to go out from me. And there stood no man with him, while Joseph made himself known unto his brethren. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard. And Joseph said unto his brethren, I am Joseph. Doth my father yet live? And his brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. So, version A, and now, Rabbi Kaplan's, Joseph could not hold in his emotions. Since all the attendants were present, he cried out, have everyone leave my presence. Thus, no one else was with him when Yosef revealed themselves to his brothers. He began to weep with such loud sobs that the Egyptians could hear it. The news of these strange happenings reached Paro's palace. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" His brothers were so startled, they could not respond. So, if you had to choose a translation to use, I personally would most certainly be using Rabbi Kaplan's, but as far as all the other ones mentioned, again, all of them have their good points and their bad points. So if you're looking for a literal translation, I personally find the best one for that is JPS 1917, if you want a word-for-word translation. But if you want to actually be able to read it, I'd recommend using Rabbi Arya Kaplan's Art Scroll or the new version of Koren for in terms of readability factor. You can also Robert Alter's is pretty good too, but again, it's being a little more academic and not having a Hebrew facing text makes it very useful if you don't speak Hebrew. But if you speak Hebrew, it's often a little frustrating because you kind of sometimes want to check it versus the Hebrew without having to get out another book. So just a brief summary. So we needed the an English translation because we don't like King James or the versions that preceded him. Because those were all Christian, right? Early translations often were simply cleaned up versions of King James, which is usable and better, but it also reminds me of what happened with the Orit in terms of what the Ethiopian Jewry had to do when they were no longer allowed to print their own books. They had to take the Christian versions and turn them Jewish again. So it works, but not without major flaws and problems and issues. And similarly, you know, Freeland GPS didn't necessarily base themselves completely off of it because they followed his style. They were very limited in their acceptance because people don't like reading Old English if they can read real English. There have been many excellent translations since of various different approaches depending on your preference. And again, main point being don't use Christian ones because, well, we don't want anybody accidentally being converted to Christianity because they decided to learn some Torah. So, thank you, everybody, for attending so far. Please send me any feedback at cmetz@torahtoro.com. Also, if anybody missed any of the lectures or would like to revisit them later, they're all in YU Torah under Art Scrolls of the Ages. And if anybody has any comments or questions on today's lecture or any of the previous ones or in general on translations, feel free to ask it. And thank you very much. There we go. Let's stop the share.